Well, it's fantastic for my latest Nostalgia interview to meet Lucinda Murphy. So the two, I guess we could almost call ourselves the two Dr. Christmases.
We could.
Because you were doing your PhD until very recently in Durham. And of course, Christmas is a book that I, or a research project that I was recently involved with. But do you want to say a little bit, Lucinda, about the journey that has taken you to study Christmas?
Thank you. Yeah. So people are often, as you might imagine, curious as to why, you know, why Christmas. And one of the things that fascinates me is that when I first started doing this, in fact, the reason I ended up doing the PhD in the first place is partly because I was so shocked that there is so little written on contemporary views about Christmas, and that actually, although we've got loads of stuff on the history of Christmas and everyone's fascinated by the traditions and the ritual and the folklore angle, if you like, and thinking about how all these things interweave, there's very little about what we think about it today, how we celebrate it today. And so that was a bit of a question for me as I was actually studying for my master's. And I thought, okay, well, why is it that this really central festival in our lives has been a bit overlooked? And it seems to me it's almost because it's too intimate, it's too personal, and so people don't think of it as a thing worthy of study necessarily.
I mean, this is the thing that I've always found, and the reason that made me so keen to study it, that we all, whether we like it or not, I was thinking of my grandfather, who always said, right, that's it. You know, he was well into his 90s. He was like, right, I've had enough of this. I'm just going to have beans on toast next year. I'm not going to go through all this. But of course, he always did go through all the rituals, maybe a little bit reluctantly. But you can't escape it. There's a John Grisham novel called Skipping Christmas. It's turned into a film called Christmas with the Cranks. And it's that idea that you can never escape it, whatever your thoughts on it, whether you come from a secular perspective or a religious perspective. And I found it intensely fascinating because it's a period of the year when it's like a time outside of time, that we do things perhaps a little bit differently, like the Scrooge narrative, we perhaps return or not to the way that we were, but there's a sense that we do things a bit differently. We talk about conversion or redemption or change or transformation, but is that just for a limited period? Is it something that is liminal? Is it something that we sort of strive at least to replicate throughout the rest of the year? But in your case, obviously you came from an anthropological background, but did you find that through studying Christmas academically, it changed the way that you understood it personally?
And again, this was like the number one question that I got asked all the way through during the project. Will studying Christmas ruin Christmas for you? And I was kind of quite defensive to start with when I first started studying the topic about this, thinking, well, you know, I mean, this is a question that people studying other things aren't asked. You know, will studying comic books ruin comic books for you? People wouldn't ask that question. So I thought, okay, well, that says something interesting about the topic. But I have to say, they were probably right to ask. You know, as I then got towards the end, and it did, I've been also joking that because Christmas involves so much of our lives, this is the excuse I'm giving for my PhD having taken quite so long as it did. There was just so much to look at. But as I got towards the end, it did start to change my orientation to Christmas itself. And I suppose, in a way, I almost wondered whether, you know, how did it affect me to be living constantly in a liminal period of time? And actually, we're not supposed to do that. You know, the whole point is we're supposed to enter from somewhere and exit. And I didn't do that. So in a way, I think I began to suffer from a little bit of a, you know, reflection overload. I was also studying it at a point in my life which was by its nature quite transitional, and I think like many people doing PhDs at this kind of age as well, I was sort of using the PhD as a way of searching for what was next and who I was about and, you know, what I was about and who I was as a person, and, you know, I was asking those questions at the same time, and it was a time of great flux personally and also, you know, nationally for us at the end at the PhD. You know, we had COVID, I was writing it in the midst of that and reflecting on how that related to people's experience of Christmas. And so I suppose, yeah, I did find that it changed my orientation to it. It hasn't dampened my love of Christmas, or my enjoyment of Christmas, I should say.
So you probably find, though, that you get called, or will increasingly get called, to sort of offer your take on it. Because I always find that the media office where I work, we're often sort of quite keen, oh, well, you've got this book on Christmas, so therefore give us a few reflections, give us a few like bullet points about what the season means for everyone. But also in terms of the way that you can steer it, because, I mean, I remember just after the book had come out, I remember it was, must have been the 1st of December, I'd recently moved house and walking past the neighbour's house, and they were quite a withdrawn couple. They didn't sort of mix with their neighbours at all, but they had the gaudiest lights, you know, 1st of December, flashing away, and you think that they're the last people I would have expected, you know, because of the nature. But I thought, gosh, so the most withdrawn couple I could imagine have got the most ostentatious display of, you know, Christmas regalia. So, and I thought then, gosh, so it was almost as though they were ahead of me on, I can't say my own season, but it almost felt like, hang on a minute, 1st of December, and they're completely living it, whereas I'm, as you were saying, you know, studying it all year round and imbibing it, listening to the Christmas music, often watching Christmas films all year round. And so I was aware that sometimes observing other people observing Christmas, even for that liminal period, was entirely fascinating. But there was also a part of me that wondered what happens for the other 300 odd days of the year.
It's an incredibly intense thing to study. And I think part of what I was trying to draw out in my work was thinking about actually just times of intensity in general. And Christmas clearly isn't the only time of, you know, intensity or celebration. And actually, COVID provided quite a good contrast there, because I thought, okay, well, actually, it's not exactly a new anthropological thing to say to be comparing times of celebration with times of crisis. And in COVID, we had, you know, celebrating Christmas, you know, during that period, we had celebration and crisis coming together in one go. And really, what I was fascinated by was the way in which those periods of intensity, whether it's celebration or crisis, actually push us into almost an emotional vortex of, you know, if you're feeling sad about things throughout the year, you're going to be feeling 100 times worse at Christmas. And we all know that. We know that anyone you speak to, you know, can come up with the sort of trope, oh, well, you know, Christmas is a wonderful time of year, but it can also be a really difficult time of year for people, and it's also very painful. So it was that sort of emotional dissonance that I was really interested in. And inevitably, talking to lots of different people about their experiences of emotional dissonance and reflecting on their lives in the midst of all these very extreme emotions, actually, became quite intense for me as a person. And I don't think I'll ever quite be able to, have to excuse the pun here, but unwrap, actually, the extent to which that took a kind of emotional and mental toll on me as well. I think we were talking a little bit before we started about the therapeutic nature of these kinds of conversations. And that was really one of the things that drew me to doing a PhD in the first place. I've always been fascinated by the kind of space, the kind of third space, actually, I think, that's created by this sort of exchange. And one of the things I find a bit sad is that when you're doing these kinds of interviews with people, almost inevitably, at the end, people say thank you. And they end up being surprised by what's come out of it, and talking about things that they perhaps never talked to anyone about before. And it just kind of, it interests me, I suppose, that, you know, other than, I suppose, a medicalised space, so I'm thinking of, you know, counselling scenarios, or, you know, maybe thinking of the Catholic confessional, where are we having these kinds of conversations? And I feel like, really, they tend to be only had in times of crisis, when people think, you know, that they're seeking out support because there's a problem with them, or there's a problem in general that they need to resolve.
And I think that's an important point, because the number of people who will dread, you know, it's like the numinous in that sense, you're as much attracted to it as repelled by it. And I think Christmas has that thing, mm-hmm. because you're drawn into something.
Yeah.
And I think you use the word vortex, but it's that sense that there's something going on here which you can't escape from, mm-hmm. but at the same time you kind of know you have to go with it. It's impossible to escape, you know, what it represents. And I think you mentioned, you know, doing a PhD, and actually there is an analogy, because I've always seen your PhD like a jigsaw in a way of, you know, you have all the pieces, or you think you have most of the pieces, but the job is to, you know in which order to put them. But something like Christmas is the eternal jigsaw, it's the eternal paradox, it's the eternal puzzle, because it's trying to, you know that you're coming from many perspectives. Some people, you know, it is a religious festival, it's not a religious festival, but then when people give their reasons for it, they're actually going against the grain of what they're, you know, ostensibly saying. It's got nothing to do with religion, but they're talking about the importance of family and love and warmth and togetherness, and you're thinking, well, that's not exactly antithetical to religion. But what I found about Christmas is that, you know, the sort of puzzle, if you like, that you bring to a PhD project of, like, dealing with a great, you know, you have a problem and you solve it in the course of 100,000 words, I was doing with something that was also happening around me in the real world, shall we say, you know, and also, so it was like applying those same skills in a way to something that wasn't just a theoretical project, but impacted on real people. And that's why, certainly when I was working on my book, I was keen not just to look at the great theoretical stuff that was out there, but to make sure that I looked at those Christmas films that you wouldn't necessarily get from, you know, all the authors. A particular focus on Christmas radio, which is kind of my thing as well. So there was a big personal element there, quite confessional about the stuff that I grew up with, and I think that was for me the most personal part, which actually made its way into the acknowledgements as well. But it also made me reflect entirely on the family and the friends that I'd grown up with, and also how interesting that straight after I finished that Christmas book, I worked on nostalgia, because what was the what was the thing that kick-started that journey? It was the paragraph or so about the relationship between Christmas and nostalgia.
Yes.
So for me, the Christmas is very much part of that continuum, and I've never quite been able to let it go.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting that you talk about this sort of sense of looking upon people, and I think we've, especially within anthropology, we talk about that all the time. I mean, this is the kind of paradox of the insider-outsider debate and how we manage that. And that sort of gaze, I suppose, and how we're involved with that reflexively or not. And so I think I had, in fact, a kind of moment in my methodology part of my PhD that talked about mirrors on mirrors, really. And I think the metaphor of a mirror in relation to Christmas is really useful. I think it almost throws a bit of I'd like to call it a sort of active mirror onto our lives. And given the fact that, you know, I am not, as a person studying this, I'm not separate from that, the kind of sense of me looking in a mirror, through another mirror into someone else's lives, and the kind of shared experience of that, I thought actually raises some interesting questions on these, you know, how we produce these kinds of studies more generally, let alone Christmas. So I felt that the topic almost gave me something back in that way as well. But nostalgia was really more strictly the thing that actually led me to the study of Christmas in the first place. I was always very interested in the study of nostalgia as an emotion. I think it's the most fascinating and one of the most complex emotions and conflicting emotions that we have, really, or at least that we've named. And towards the end of my undergraduate degree, which was also in theology and religion, I'd moved more into the social sciences by that point. And I actually grew up singing in my church choir as a chorister, and that was something that was incredibly personal and significant to me. And when I went to Durham for my undergraduate, and continued to sing in chapel choirs and sort of part of that scene, and it was quite a question for me that I realised that the people who had kind of cultivated this skill to a high level, the majority of them were not only not really religious, some of them were actually kind of quite actively anti-religious. And so I thought, well, that's kind of a bit of a paradox that we're here leading the worship and singing these spiritual anthems and hymns, and yet actually there's something quite different going on. And so it made me sort of reflect a lot on performance. I've always been fascinated by performance my whole life, really. Did a lot of performing arts stuff as I was growing up. And I think also was quite a naturally shy person growing up. And I'd sort of, I'm one of these people who'd, I think it's difficult to find a category sometimes. I think we can over-label these things. But I think I'd describe myself as a introverted extrovert, really. And actually, I think that kind of gives me an interesting relationship to the study of performance, because my whole being, my whole social being, has been very much about a conscious sense of performance in that way, and probably doing a lot of performing arts as a child was the thing that gave me the confidence to be able to do that. So I guess that's a kind of almost reflexive outing that I have to kind of be
it's
aware of.
It's actually really funny that you say that, because a colleague at work said the other day, he said, Chris, he said, do you know what? He said, I think you're an extrovert, maybe a shy one. An introverted one. You know, I sort of see myself as a slightly, sometimes socially awkward extrovert, and the different sides to different facets of one's life, you know, come to light.
Absolutely.
It's almost as though, like, doing a podcast like this, you know, it's the sort of thing that maybe a few decades ago I might have thought, oh, I can't possibly do that, even though I've always wanted to do something in radio. It's almost like, oh, I can't do that, because unless you're really, you think you're going to be, like, amazing at it or something, you know, you think, I'm not ready to do that.
Yeah.
But there's always a time sometimes when you think, well, actually, now, if I don't take the plunge now, you know, for me, 2018, it was like, you know, all the ducks, as it were sort of lined up. But interesting that performance then has played such a big role, because I suppose when you're talking about Christmas performance, I mean, even now already, but we're doing this interview in the last week of October, and, you know, my children already have all their Christmas schedules at school completely sorted. And a colleague yesterday, I thought of you, was saying that she said that her work colleague, so a line manager at work in Bristol where she lives, told her to, you know, sort out her Christmas holiday arrangements, and she was thinking, isn't it a bit early for that? And I thought, well, you know, we'll have to form the council, you know, and the two of us should decide the answer to that one. But it's that sort of notion all the way through it of knowing that something's important, but not necessarily knowing if you're quite ready to fulfil that, to live that out. But then to have that perspective on other people who are doing just that, maybe at different stages, and then you realise that maybe you're catching them up or replicating what they're doing a few decades after the event.
And feeling, I suppose, almost in between. I think anyone who can call themselves an introvert in some way, I think we all have that sort of fascination with inner experience. And I think probably in some ways, to be an academic, most of us have that sort of impulse and that kind of impulse to reflect. And it's something that I think we often don't talk about, because we're all probably of a certain sort of mentality and personality type. But there are an awful lot of people who don't necessarily think in that way, and who aren't necessarily represented in these sorts of conversations. But I have always had that sense, and it's always given me a fascination with, you know, actually psychology, really. And I suppose that's what I was sort of doing towards the end of my undergraduate degree. I realised that one of the things I loved about studying theology and religion was the interdisciplinary nature of it, and the fact that, you know, that I was doing so many different sort of introductory subjects in one. And in fact, actually, that's one of the reasons I ended up doing a master's, because I sort of felt at the end of my undergraduate, wow, I've had an amazing time, but I still feel like I've only dipped into various different things. And I actually pushed it down. I wanted to do something more psychological, so I ended up studying psychology of religion, actually, for my master's. Partly because I thought I might want to be a counsellor. And in a way, through doing empirical work, I feel like I've sort of managed to combine aspects of that tendency, you know, and want. And before I went to university, I was convinced I wanted to be a journalist. And I took a gap year to work for various magazines and newspapers during that. And I now, looking back on that, reflect on that and think, actually, this is all the same set of skills. It's just been an experiment as to what hat I want to wear whilst I'm being involved in hearing about people's lives. And really, I suppose towards the end of that undergraduate degree, as I was trying to decide what to focus on for my dissertation, this kind of question of choral singing and that dissonance coming back to that, it was really coming up for me, because I suppose it was always my kind of big passion in life. And so I ended up interviewing ex choristers from Durham Cathedral, thinking that actually that's an even more intense atmosphere and experience to have grown up in a cathedral setting where you're singing the services every day and you're in a boarding school situation. And the main thing that came out of those interviews was nostalgia. I wanted to know what happened to these guys as they progressed through their life course. How did that experience, that early experience in life, affect their relationship to faith and religion per se? Did it actually put them off? Was there not as much, can we say that there's a relationship, and in what way? And the more that I spoke to them, I mean, it was a very small case study of people, but there was a common theme, wherever they were coming from on it, that I almost, in reflecting on the interviews afterwards, realised that I was almost making a category mistake in the way that I was asking the questions in my head, and that their descriptions of, their faith couldn't really be separated to that extent from their descriptions of their love of the music and the aesthetics of the building and the way all of those things came together. And even if they'd been put off by religion at some point, after they'd left that experience and into their adulthood, most of them had come back into the cathedral setting because it was their home, because it was where they'd grown up, and because they felt a great deal of nostalgia for that space. And it was, in times of distress that they were often drawn back. And in fact, there was one person I interviewed who'd had a conversion experience at about sort of 55, having been quite anti-religious, because it was a natural place for him to go. He was going through a messy divorce. It was a dark period of his life. And he came back to the cathedral because this was of great comfort, and he then found God at that point. And I thought, well, that's fascinating. And in some ways, this space is sort of functioning as a sort of resource. And I suppose, thinking from more of a church perspective, that interested me. I thought, well, there's such an understandable drive at the moment, especially within the Church of England, to think about, to worry about the declining numbers on a Sunday, and to be thinking about how to welcome people and how to come up with new schemes to welcome people in. But these guys were being drawn back to a certain rhythm and a structure, which has almost become a little bit outdated now, because it appears inaccessible to people not familiar with the setting. And so in a way, I think that those themes of tradition and familiarity are getting a little bit lost. And it's those threads of continuity that I feel many of us, whether we're strictly religious in that sense of the term religious or not, are seeking and want to find comfort in.
It's that notion of counterpoint, I think, that opposite, that when you're growing up, if you're exposed to religion a lot, you may well continue on that journey, or you may well do as a lot of children, people I know whose parents are priests, often they sort of say, oh, actually, they resist that path because it was sort of like they grew up in a particular household and they want to explore something different, they want to live their own life. But the number of times they come back to that, the number of people I know who grew up, I knew them as rebels, and then a few years later they're like, no, I'm going to go into the church. And you're thinking, first of all, you're the last person I thought would do that.
Yeah.
Then you think, in a way, the fact that you seem to be espousing the opposite is your way of rebellion. And then you reach a certain point and you're like, no, you need to go home, psychologically, emotionally, not just geographically. And what you said is very true, that sometimes the things that we want to do, the urges that we have, the needs, whether the religion, the path that we follow, often comes because we've experienced the complete opposite. Mm. You know, it's like the Truman Show type thing. Sometimes, you know, if you're exposed to something day in, day out, rather than think, I feel safe here, you need, you know, university affords that, academic study, a PhD affords that, the chance to do something a little bit, in some cases, transgressive, the chance to actually explore areas, do things that are outside your comfort zone. But then it's the Dorothy Wizard of Oz scenario. You come back in a way renewed and refreshed. But it's interesting that without that adventure, you couldn't have made that big leap. But I was going to ask you whether there's this sense of inevitability in your case as well, because you mentioned that you considered journalism. But do you kind of feel that you're doing now, maybe not what you expected to do, but do you kind of feel that it's all worked out kind of the right way, even though you couldn't have foreseen that it would have gone this way a few years or even decades ago?
I mean, I've joked with a vast number of people recently that I could never have envisaged becoming Dr. Christmas. That was definitely not on the cards in any possible way. But when I think of the skill sets that I've been drawn to, yes, I can absolutely see. And in fact, you know, so actually currently I'm working in a school. It's a bit of a kind of transitionary job for me, but it's actually kind of allowing me to explore different things, and I'm kind of keen to actually find a way of I suppose finding a more, you know, practical sort of pastoral application of what I've done in my study of Christmas, because I think, you know, for a lot of people it was almost too covered in tinsel to be able to sort of actually really see what was at the heart of it. And the angle that I was most interested in taking was thinking about how Christmas holds a mirror up to the key life transitions that we go through on our life course, and how people thinking about actually well-being and how people navigate transition, but also, I suppose, crisis, to use that word, dissonance, how they navigate change. And Christmas is a time, you know, in which all of that becomes very intensified, and so I think, you know, it's almost like a litmus test, isn't it, for social studies, to be able to really view that. And it becomes a litmus test for us personally as well in our lives, so that brings us back to that mirrors on mirrors thing. So I think it's a perfect window case study to be able to study a, you know, vast number of other things, and social circumstance as well. And so I suppose, yeah, I'm really keen to be able to use some of that work to be able to really, actually it sounds a cliche, but to be able to actually help people. Because I guess I've got a personal fear of the ivory tower, really. And that was one of the things, I mean, I was considering being a counsellor in the first place. I was drawn to interviewing people very much from that angle. And I suppose I was really experimenting for myself with that. And, you know, thinking about, okay, actually, what happens in this space, thinking about how the university itself, the academy, relates to people, and thinking about that ethically. You know, I spent quite a lot of time, arguably too much time, during my PhD process thinking about the methodology in relation to that and in relation to community engagement, which we're very keen to discuss as universities at the moment, but I feel like, you know, is often a very top-down, ends up being a top-down approach. Kind of quite understandably, you know, universities are businesses like any other business, and it ends up being about the university, you know, reaching out for its own ends. And so in thinking about that, I suppose it's led me to kind of, I suppose, review my own personal journey. And I've ended up I'm mentoring people in a school. I'm working with special needs children at the moment, and actually in some ways it seems like a bit of a strange sidestep, but in other ways it's not, because I mean, I say to them, this is a key transition in your life, and actually learning the skill of being able to negotiate big changes and work out what's next is almost more important than anything else that we learn in school. So that's sort of really enabling me to kind of really think about what I've done in a different way, and actually give me a bit of a break as well from that sort of intensity of thinking.
Yeah, but also that learning from experience angle, which is invaluable. And I find, I mean, even through doing the podcast, that you learn, you know, you see things in a slightly more askance kind of way, an oblique sort of way. Like what you were saying as well about Christmas, you know, and the therapeutic element. I always found that the tropes almost impossible to deconstruct. Even when you think of a film that seems to be as far away from Christmas like a Bad Santa, if you've seen that. But a colleague at work the other day was saying, you know, is there a film that I could screen before Christmas that kind of is like a Christmas oblique film? So it's not necessarily a traditional Christmas film, but it will get people talking. But it still follows the same conventions. And that's the kind of thing that we can disrupt it. We can try to take it apart. We can try to refuse to engage with it. But at the end of the day, it still has this mythological hold over us. That whatever we do, we may renounce it, we turn our back on it, but Christmas carries on. Whatever name we give it, and of course, you know, often people say, well, you shouldn't call it Christmas, because it's and in fact, actually, this came up in relation to some of the TV work that I'm doing as well. They were like, well, we have to be careful as well, not, you know, we have to remember that not everybody celebrates Christmas. And I was thinking, yeah, but whatever word we use for it, it's not simply a festival for Christians, because if you start deconstructing it, you find that, you know, when people talk about their favourite Christmas films or people celebrate Christmas, it means often a break from work or time to spend time with family. I asked my students a few years ago, if there was one word they associate with Christmas, what would it be? And you might expect it to be church or religion or whatever. And quite a few said family, but one said clubbing, other said dancing. What they really meant was they're going with their friends to a social space. Yeah. And again, you know, these were class of religious studies students. So I was just thinking, you know, that the unexpected nature of that kind of answer, I think, is indicative of the way that that word conjures up so much good and bad for so many people.
Mm. And really, I suppose, to me, it's about the most personal and intimate parts of our lives, and that's why I think it's so interesting to study and think about. And I suppose, in some ways, thinking about the way that I was personally drawn into this, I'd been studying nostalgia in, I guess, another ritual setting, and I wanted to see how that could expand, you know, and obviously church music is a very niche sort of thing. It doesn't really affect that many people, and yet actually it was this sense that you can't escape Christmas, that actually even if you don't celebrate it and you've got a problem with it and you feel alienated by it, which, you know, great number of people really do, whether for religious reasons or actually for reasons of personal trauma. And I spoke to several people who were in that position where they hadn't celebrated Christmas for some time because something really terrible had happened to them at an earlier point in their lives. They'd had abusive childhoods, or I spoke to one woman who'd been divorced over Christmas and her husband had left her on Christmas Eve. Women who've had miscarriages, it brings up all sorts of pain for people, and so people don't celebrate for all sorts of different reasons and feel alienated for all sorts of different reasons at a time, I suppose, in which we're all pulling together and the message is all about social bonding and solidarity and love and actually the way that we think society should be. There's a utopian aspect to this, which can be disintegrating as much as it can be integrating for others. But the very fact that even if you don't celebrate it or you've got an issue with it, that it brings out kind of strong emotions, I think it gives us a kind of a sense of where people are at in relation to the wider society and the wider society in which they live. And as an anthropologist, I can't think of a more apt time to study. And that is exactly what we're always trying to study, the relationship between the individual and society, and how belief and worldview actually relates to that.
Because I'm also intrigued in that almost the wasteland of the post-Christmas period, because we have so much investment in, and of course the old adage, of course Christmas goes on too long, but what do you do after Christmas? And you know, I always think the Scrooge story ends, of course, on Boxing Day, really. But what happens? Is Scrooge the same misanthrope? You know, is he changed just for a liminal period? Does he revert to type? And of course, the fact we don't know the answer also is what makes the Scrooge story, the Dickens narrative, so compelling, that we can read so much into that. But that's the bit that works for me. It's like J. generally with people, you have a sense of what this person represents. What is your relationship to that person? And Christmas, of course, heightens a lot of these associations. What you do afterwards, do you carry, you know, the wave of Christmas? You know, is there a point where it has to end? Because if we celebrated Christmas or lived in that Christmas mode all year round, you know, we'd probably be quite, you know, it'd be exhausting.
Yes, and I think that's why I'm so exhausted, Chris, now. It's been a while.
Well actually, a good analogy. I remember once, the furthest place I've ever been on holiday is Hawaii, and that was in 2007. You know, extraordinary, because I don't normally travel that far. I remember going there and thinking, gosh, for a lot of people, think of the David Lodge novel Paradise News. You know, this is almost, you know, this is close to heaven, you know, it could be. But if you live in paradise, if you live in Hawaii, a holiday probably for you would be going to a big urban, you know, New York or somewhere, or London, you know, somewhere where the weather isn't quite, you know, so wonderful, and it's all very built up and very urban, and you have a different sort of experience, and you can go back renewed and refreshed to the holiday resort. So that notion of counterpoint comes up again. But I find that with Christmas, is that what happens after Christmas? What do you do with that? Because I always used to find this real bump. I know there's always that classic, is that something like the third Monday of January or Tuesday, which is supposed to be the lowest day of the year. I find it hits me a lot closer to that early January, certainly when I was younger, because you got all this invested in Christmas and then you don't always plan for the what after, and it's that return to some kind of normality when you feel, well, hang on, what are there lessons that should have been learned, or are we just going through the motions? I think that's what prompted me to write the Christmas book, because I had a real problem with this idea that if this thing is so special, if we need to engage with it, if we have no choice but to engage with it, and we just carry on as if nothing had happened once we hit January, I always feel, well, in that case, we're kind of just going through the motions, and that perhaps wouldn't, in the way that, you know, a summer holiday or something would, you know, naturally you have a time and you want to return to normal life sometimes. You certainly can't afford to stay on holiday forever. But with Christmas, did you find that made Christmas a bit more distinctive for those kind of reasons?
I mean, I think it's interesting. I think almost there's a bit of an anti-climax in two different ways. There's the kind of emotional anti-climax, which people experience in a number of different ways. And children, I mean, I interviewed a lot of children as part of my project as well. I spent a lot of time in a primary school. And, you know, some of the emotional responses that they would give as to the, you know, I asked them exactly the same questions that I asked of the adults that I interviewed. What kinds of emotions did they associate with Christmas? And I think this was another interesting thing that came out of the research, actually, that a lot of the grown-ups that I interviewed assumed that the children's responses would all be about happiness and excitement. And actually, they were just as mixed. Actually, of course, they were just as mixed as the adults' responses. But the fact that we expect them to be all about happiness in some ways, I think, says something about the role we give childhood and the romanticisation of childhood that is going on in our kind of ideology of Christmas. And so they would list, you know, boredom as, you know, and fear, some of them. And that might sound quite dark, but actually a lot of them talked about being nervous and scared. And, you know, nervous that they weren't going to get their presents. And, you know, we could actually judge that, you know, in some ways. And I've had many people, you know, say, oh, yeah, all kids care about is getting their presents. I'm like, actually, if we've linked, you know, getting their presents to, you know, good behaviour, that's actually a much deeper fear than something that's just about material goods. And sadness and disappointment when, you know, they don't get what they want, or actually there's a huge build-up of excitement. Actually, some of that excitement can be quite disturbing to some. I interviewed the mother of an autistic child, you know, who found Christmas extremely difficult, couldn't deal with the extremity of emotion, and she found it incredibly difficult to manage as a parent, with all these expectations of how children should be and what it. I think it's really about expectation, and I think that's the main thing. After Christmas, we have a certain expectation around it, and we sort of lose that, and there's a fall off. So I think there's that emotional side, but then there's also the ideological side, the morality story that we're all telling in various different hues and different colours. Some more overtly religious than others, and some, I suppose, what you might call the more implicit religion of, you know, the Dickensian Christmas and the Scrooge redemption story. And I think, you know, there's that age-old idea that, you know, and this is another thing that came out, it didn't matter what, you know, what kind of religious belief people held, where they were coming from, what their worldview was. The people that I interviewed all thought that the true meaning of Christmas had been lost. It's lost. And in the Christmas literature, as you know, it's always referred to as the Christmas lament. And one of the things that I found so interesting in kind of reading around this was that actually that lament has been around, you know, really since the 17th, 18th century. It's been there for a long time. And just that sense of, do you know what, we have to find something that's wrong with society. And that's wrong with, therefore, Christmas, as a microcosm of that, and something that's wrong with our lives, coming back to the more personal, emotional side of things, in order to be able to assess it, and in order to be able to put something back together. So it almost seems like the Christmas lament becomes an important, integral part of that process of annual reflection. People are inevitably cynical when we get to the end of Christmas and, you know, people go back to the way that they were before. But viewing this now, having kind of listened to a lot of people talk about it, I think that's an important part of this annual process of renewal that we all go through, that very, very criticism.
I like that idea of the loss being bound up, well, I forgive the pun, the presence, you know.
Yeah.
But it's an important point, in the same with, you know, I teach a module called The Death of God. Mm. And of course, in order to understand God and theism, you need to know its opposite. You need to know that actually, what are the factors that might not make an environment conducive, and actually people who are obsessed often with those very questions are themselves struggling. It's not that they're anti-religious or even atheistic, but it's that there's a struggle within them, and they see a conflict, and it may or may not be resolved, you know, ever. But also it's part of a wider sort of culture. But I wonder, you know, was it ever there in the first place? Because if the loss is intrinsically bound up with the presence of something, then in a way, the idea that we had it when we were young, or did we not feel, or maybe we grew up in a household where the parents were talking about that very loss. So what is the optimum Christmas? I mean, I'm somebody who has always kept a diary, and I, you know, in that sense, you'd imagine that if childhood was this amazing kind of thing, that there would be this, almost this template for that. I'm not sure there is. Mm. Or at least maybe we are good at composites, the composite Christmas. We put all the good bits together, and often put the bad bits together, but not always at the same time. The idea of there being the perfect Christmas, there may be bits of Christmas that are perfect, but are we necessarily imagining that there is, you know, everyone came together at the same moment? Is that something that you've
definitely, yeah,
on?
And in many ways, I think in short, we can think of Christmas as a utopia land. Yeah. In fact, yesterday I was very excited. I thought, gosh, this is very well timed before I'm doing an interview on nostalgia. Yeah. I went to the exhibition currently on at the Excel to celebrate 100 years of Disney, and you know, all the same themes, and in fact actually I did reflect through my PhD on the comparison between Disneyland as the happiest place on earth and Christmas as the most wonderful time of the year. That sort of enchantment, that sort of childhood magic, is exactly the same sort of thing. And it fascinates me that, you know, the various different ills that we find in society and that we all start talking about at Christmas, the fact that we, you know, it's a time to give money to charity. A lot of people associate, you know, Christmas with that. And actually thinking about what's wrong in our families, you know, that's the elephant in the room, isn't it? I mean, for a lot of people, that is what Christmas is about. It's negotiating who goes where at what time, what family ruptures there are, who you visit or you don't visit, who's coming to stay or who's not coming to stay, what's gone on in the year, who's not present at the table anymore, all of those changes and things. And so really, yes, I think it's about our vision. And in that way, it's a deeply religious event that we're envisaging our utopia, our ideal version of society, but also thinking about our personal dreams. And that brings us back to our Santa wish list. Yes. And, you know, what is it that you really want? And again, a deeply Disney-infused sort of idea, you know, a dream is a wish your heart makes, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And it strikes me that being such a child-centric festival as well, actually, Disney probably isn't so unrelated to this either, that, you know, we have now seen more than several generations go through a very Disney-infused type culture and exposed to those sorts of ideas. So I think that probably has had more of a direct relationship with the way that we think about Christmas.
And there is a Disney film from 1985 called One Magic Christmas, mm-hmm. Which deals with, you know, Father Christmas almost as this figure who raises from the dead. You know, it's sort of like conflating Jesus and Santa. It's not Mary Steenburgen is in it, and it's not a particularly well-known Disney film, but it has all the ingredients in it.
Yes.
But I'm almost wondering whether, because it perhaps deals in a more explicit way some of those tropes, that actually it's almost like not quite, that, you know, the world is not quite ready for that. It's almost as though it's a little bit too focused.
Yes.
You know, just surprising, because, you know, as somebody studying Christmas, it was one of the most fascinating films I'd ever watched.
Yeah.
And yet very few people had heard of it. So again, there's that thing that with Christmas, that all the things you're mentioning are absolutely spot on, that people don't necessarily want to acknowledge that.
No.
That they'll say talk about the importance of family, mm-hmm. but it's family that is the problem. What's the best thing about Christmas? Family. What's the worst thing about Christmas? Family.
Yeah.
And often, you know, so therefore, what's the solution? But actually,
yes.
You don't follow through on what is perhaps the obvious logical corollary.
Yes. And in many ways, this is what I found so fascinating about it, because it is a paradox. The whole thing is a paradox. And this brings me back to performance as well, because it is also a performance. It's a performance of an ideology and of a utopia. We all perform utopian land, and the Father Christmas myth and legend is absolutely part of that. It is a literal performance in the home, this is probably the real reason I ended up studying Christmas. My family, we still perform it, you know. My sister and I are now, you know, very much grown up, and yet we're still it's absolutely blasphemy to talk about Father Christmas in any other way. And we all handle that in slightly different ways. We are performing our kind of best versions of ourselves, you know, trying to mind what we say at the Christmas dinner table. And so the fact that it always has that underside, in the same way that Disney also has that underside as well, is, I suppose, I was reflecting yesterday, you know, Walt Disney theme parks, that kind of 1950s attitude, in a way. I mean, it is one of the best sort of tangible manifestations of the American dream that I can think of, and a sort of strange mix of Protestant work ethic sort of mentality. And I think, you know, the way that we see Christmas is very much part of that. One thing that I spent a lot of time thinking about through my PhD writing was the Christmas spirit and the notion of the Christmas spirit. How this is, what is it? Is it an emotion? Is it, you know, something kind of more spiritual? How do people envisage that? And there's a pressure around it. You've got to get into the Christmas spirit. If you're not in the Christmas spirit, you're a party pooper. You're not taking it seriously. How does it relate to the British spirit as well? And that kind of wartime spirit, which was another interesting thing to think about during COVID, actually, that kind of overlap and the kind of emotional resonance of these sorts of terms. But it is absolutely a performance, and there's always going to be another side to that performance, and that was what fascinated me, really, that dissonance.
And I'm just thinking as well of the Wizard song, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day.
Mm.
Now, you effectively lived Christmas every day in one form or another. Is that the thing? Is Christmas something that we need to have in terms of the calendar, we need to have a very specific set of contours around that, almost. We need to sort of wrap it up, you know, again, and say, you know, this is what Christmas is, and then we come out of that. But how did you find doing your PhD all year round imbibing this? Did it change your understanding of Christmas itself, or did it make you appreciate it more because you were almost like doing the transgressive thing of living it and experiencing it outside of its proper calendrical constraints? And then did it free you up in any way, or did you find that when the real Christmas came along you were sort of out of season?
I mean, I suppose, again, thinking about this mirrors sort of image, it only intensified what I would have felt already at Christmas. And there was a deep irony towards the end of my PhD where actually my deadline kept being, it was consistently for a couple of years, I had to extend it several times, and the deadline was right at the end of the Christmas period. And so actually Christmas became actually an awful time for me, because I was sort of thinking, oh my goodness, this is so ironic, I'm writing a PhD on Christmas, and actually, because, you know, I need to go and celebrate Christmas with my family, I'm then losing time before my deadline, and I'm not going to be able to submit on time. And so actually my worry about finishing my PhD, Christmas was a block to that. And because it was that time of year, I was thinking about the fact that, oh, another Christmas has come by and I still haven't finished my PhD on Christmas. Yeah. And I couldn't have thought of anything more reflexive than that. Yeah. But one figure that I haven't really mentioned yet, who really embodies the mirrors on mirrors idea, is, of course, Gelf the Elf, who... for anyone not aware listening to this podcast, was my research assistant, or the small elf that I named my research assistant throughout my PhD. And it kind of happened almost by accident, actually, as I think many good things do. As I was sort of in the first year of the PhD, my mum actually works in a lot of primary schools, and she'd I remember I was sort of as you do in the first year of PhDs, I was sort of very lost in various texts of reading, and I didn't quite know where I was going with things, and I don't know, I was feeling a bit confuzzled by various things. And my mum, I remember she rang and it was getting towards Christmas, and she'd suddenly realised that elves were a big deal. And she said, Luce, I think you've got to stop everything you're doing, and I think you need to think about elves, because, you know, 50% of my class now have an elf. I thought, right, okay. So it was sort of vaguely on my radar. Then I think I ended up going to a conference, and I was talking about Christmas magic. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, how can I really get this across? And, you know, it felt almost wrong to be in a formal setting talking about Christmas magic, you know. I wanted to really try and bring it alive, so to speak, to people. And so, well, do you know what? I'd bought one of these elves as a kind of experiment, almost, to just see what was in the box, because I was intrigued about it. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take the elf along and see how it goes down. And so I ended up sort of featuring her as part of this thing. And the more that I looked, the more that I could see that people were, you know, sharing what they also done on social media. And I suddenly realised, oh, do you know, I started taking pictures of her doing various different things. And I realised that in doing that, I was sort of mimicking what these parents were doing on social media. And I thought, do you know what, actually, that's kind of quite interesting, because this is a different form of ethnographic inscription. It's not writing, it's performative. And thinking about that focus on performance again, I suddenly realised, you know what, this is actually a much better medium through which to tell this story than my writing might be. So it was actually a different way of expressing what I felt couldn't be expressed in words, which, in studying something so intimate and personal as Christmas, I just felt was really, really important. How can you talk about magic in black and white? It's just wrong. And so in the end, she took on a life of her own. And she became extremely connected to my identity. And she actually became a subliminal way of me, I suppose, telling my personal story in a non-obvious way. So actually, through the more difficult phases and periods of time, you know, I will, you know, be quite open about the fact that I really struggled towards the end of my PhD. And it was quite a difficult time for me personally. I was able to, I suppose, use her as a medium, you know, to try and tell the understory of Christmas as well. and of our lives and the stuff that, you know, we can't put on social media. And some people do, but even when they do, it's a performance. Yeah. And so I suppose I was trying to use her as an experiment to think about reflexivity. And also to kind of keep me going. It was companionship, actually, weirdly. I feel like I've got a bit of a weird reputation now for wandering around with a small elephant toe. But, you know, I talked about her as, you know, the feels that I carried around in my pocket. She literally was subverting the line between subject and object. She was me. She was the anthropologist. I called her a she deliberately. GELF, by the way, stands for girl elf. Just to prove that, you know, girl elves can do PhDs too. And you might have noticed that, so I graduated a couple of months ago and had her cross the stage with me. yes, a friend of mine actually knitted her a tiny little PhD gown. So I was very keen that she should be an important part of every stage of the process, that she should join up the experiences of the field with the experience of writing, which I think often gets left behind. And when it was so personal, I just thought that that was something that I wanted to kind of be able to integrate. And she sat there in my PhD viva as well.
I was just going to ask you.
Yeah, of course. That was an important, I mean, it was kind of funny, but it was also, to me, an important part of my methodology, that she was there as a literal embodiment of all of the interactions and all of the experiences that we had together. And really through the beginning of my PhD, so Douglas Davies, my supervisor for my PhD, was getting very interested in the idea of individuality as a concept for thinking about personhood, and particularly for thinking about loss. And I have to say, having studied psychology, I was a little bit sceptical about it to start with, because I was sort of wondering, well, where's the ego gone? Where's the I? Who's controlling this individuality thing? Where's the individual left? But when you think about it, individual is literally made up of that sort of term anyway. And I suppose the whole concept is about thinking of ourselves as not necessarily just isolated beings, but as composite parts of all of our experiences and interactions. And so in that way, it's actually a deeply sort of anthropological idea. It is an anthropological idea, but it is almost a social constructionist sort of approach, told from a different angle, because it's about the way that we kind of imbibe experiences and they become soaked into our identity. So to me, that's almost an answer to the paradox of insider outsider, that it's neither one or the other. We're always insiders and we're always outsiders, and every person I interviewed was both an insider and an outsider to the experiences of Christmas, you know, and the expectations that come with that. And so I suppose she was part of that process of discovery as well, and merged, you know, with the process. I should say as well, one of the reasons that I decided, you know, so consciously to take her in tow was also to get around the issue of consent with children. As I was doing the work in the primary school, I thought, well, I needed some kind of tool, some kind of prop that would enable me to explain what I was doing to them. And I did quite a lot of thinking around that and, you know, thought, okay, well, actually, this will be a good way of me explaining what anthropology is. And so again, it kind of, I think, subverted various different things. I was sort of thinking of myself of, I guess, doing anthropology at home, but I was able to tell a different story about her coming from the North Pole to study a different society. And so actually, it was a kind of way of making sure they knew what I was doing, but giving the research its own story as well. And what was absolutely, I mean, it was charming, but also fascinating, that eventually, because she sort of came with me into the classroom, many of them would bring their own elves into school as well. And so she made friends. And, you know, honestly, these children were absolutely drawn into this. And I had queues of people in the morning kind of lining up to tell me what their elves had done. And I mean, Douglas at one point said, it's almost like you've become a sort of, you know, shaman, sort of, you know, you've got access to this magic. And I think, you know, what was actually also quite challenging was that people have different rules of, you know, in terms of who's allowed to touch the elf, you know, and when. So the Elf on the Shelf brand has a rule where you can't touch them, because if you touch them, they lose their magic. So there were some children who had a real problem with the fact that I was touching the elf, or had a problem when other children touched the elf. And so it was actually quite interesting in terms of actually just managing their different beliefs. And I had fascinating focus groups discussions with children of various different ages on how Christmas magic worked, and, you know, how she could be a toy and yet not a toy at the same time. And really quite sophisticated explanations really coming from them. So it was just a really useful way of getting around so many different things.
So I have to ask, how did Gelf deal with the end of the PhD? Dare I ask where she is now?
Well, I did have a very, very funny moment right at the end. In fact, as I was submitting, so I had quite a stressful time submitting because I was actually having to move house at the same time. And in the midst of this, so I had this crazy day where I, you know, of course I thought I'd be, you know, finished several days in advance, but no, I actually managed to submit my day on the same day that I moved out of my house. And so I had several friends almost carrying me out on a stretcher out of this house. And in the midst of the flurry of everything, I think I must have set Gelf to one side in some way in order to kind of make sure she didn't end up in a removal van. And she got lost. And one of my friends said to me, I was distraught. One of my friends said to me, wow, it's almost like Mary Poppins, isn't it? You know, she's come into your life, you've submitted your PhD, and now she's vanished and the magic is gone. And honestly, eventually I will just reassure you that she was refound in time to graduate with me. And we found her eventually amidst many boxes, but it was a very funny moment.
Well, if Gelf ever wanted to do a nostalgia interview with me, she'd be very, very welcome. Yeah, I've literally got a couple more questions to ask you, and I have to ask this.
Yes.
Favourite Christmas film?
Favourite Christmas film. Okay, so I would say, for me, it's between It's a Wonderful Life, which is a very personal favourite. It was also my grandfather's favourite, so there's a kind of a bit of a family link. I just love the story. It's such a classic. And Love Actually, as a modern one, I just think it sums up so much, and it sort of had such a British sort of angle as well, which I think captures that sort of British humour really well.
Yeah. And favourite song, favourite Christmas song, if you have one.
Favourite Christmas song. It's a bit of a miserable one, actually, in some ways, but probably Last Christmas.
Oh, the Wham one.
Yeah. Because I think it captures that sense of conflicting emotions so well.
Well, plenty of nostalgia in terms of the way it's always the previous one that seemed to represent something that's now fallen away.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it sums up that whole kind of matrix very well.
So you see everything comes together beautifully. The music, the film, the study of Christmas, the reasons, you know, there's a complete link. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure for two Dr. Christmases to meet here at the Quaker House in London. Thank you, Lucinda, for being my guest this week.
Thank you.